Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Banks. You can love them or you can hate them, but you just can't run an economy without them. And not just the big ones either. Today, banks beyond Wall Street. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the Kirby bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is great to have you with us on this Thursday. It is the 15th of October today. And the banking industry came in with mixed results this morning. Or more properly, I should say that the part of the banking industry that gets most of the attention came in with mixed results. Goldman Sachs and Citigroup both released better than expected quarterly earnings reports this morning. Goldman is making buckets full of money. Citigroup is still in the red, just not as badly as everybody expected. So that's two. Two of the plus or minus 8,000 banks in this country that have to be working right for the economy to get better. So we asked Marketplace's Jeff Tyler how the smaller banks, the ones we don't hear so much about, might be doing.
The situation for smaller banks is spotty. In parts of the country hard hit by the recession or the subprime lending mess, savings and loan customers are struggling to pay their debts. Paul Mirsky is chief economist with the Independent Community Bankers of America. He says, on the whole, the situation for small banks isn't so bad, and it's getting better.
The small banks, banks of $1 billion and under, were the only segment of the banking sector that increased their net loans and leases in the latest quarter reported by the FDIC.
Mirsky says community banks are finding new opportunities.
They are already picking up increased small business lending opportunities from the large banks like Bank of America and others who have dropped big chunks of small business lending customers.
Individual customers seem to have kept the faith with small banks, says Wayne Abernathy. He's with the American Bankers Association.
Deposit levels have continued to hold up very well.
But he says there's still some uncertainty.
There are some dark clouds on the horizon that we hope will blow away and won't come across the industry.
Those clouds include potential new restrictions. He says regulators will say to small banks,
so rather than making that loan, why don't you hang on to that money because there's probably some more losses coming at you.
In addition, Abernathy worries about inflation or higher interest rates, either of which could slow banks' return to profitability. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
In the House of Representatives today, there was a very small first step toward new regulations for that banking industry. The House Financial Services Committee passed new rules for derivatives, essentially complicated insurance policies against future changes in prices. In their unregulated heyday, derivatives were used to bet on the direction of everything from real estate to interest rates. They were responsible, in part, for what happened to the Lehman Brothers and AIG. Reformers figure that if derivative trading was more public, that would take care of a lot of the abuses. John Dimsdale reports now from Washington.
The bill would require the trading of derivatives on an open exchange, and that's a form of regulation, says University of Maryland law professor Michael Greenberger.
If they are traded on exchange, they're public, they're transparent, the prices are well set and well established.
Lots of industries use derivatives to insure against changes in commodity prices or interest rates or foreign currency values. Energy companies, retailers, phone companies, car dealers all successfully lobbied lawmakers for broad exemptions from the exchange requirement.
Unfortunately, I think too many devilish hands worked on this, and the exemptions to the general regulatory requirement almost eat the exchange trading requirement away.
But Barbara Matthews, a regulatory consultant, says derivative traders oppose regulated exchanges because they reduce flexibility and increase the cost of doing business.
In order to trade on an exchange, the contracts themselves need to be standardized. Trying to fit everything into that one box, standard contract terms, standard expiration dates, creates big problems for corporate America.
Not exempted from the exchange requirement are banks and Wall Street investment firms. Lawmakers think they traded derivatives for more speculative reasons, but there's still plenty of opportunity for bank lobbyists to add even more exemptions, since several more congressional committees will review the bill. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Put on your thinking caps, everybody. Here is today's Marketplace pop quiz. With unemployment still rising and consumers still wondering if it's safe to spend again, not to mention everybody's memories of the crash of last fall, what is driving the Dow? The blue chips are up 50% from the lows they hit back in March. They closed over 10,000 again today. So once again, where is that money coming from? Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
Is this for real or just the giddy response of banks and other big money investors on too much government medication? Some market analysts say it's easy for the Dow to climb the way it has when the government has injected the financial system with so much cheap money. Richard Suttmeyer is chief market strategist at ValueEngine.com.
Firms like Goldman Sachs and the hedge funds, they can just power the market higher. They have the performance benchmarks they have to make. So it's really professional investors' money that's driving this market. The individuals are only involved if they have money in mutual funds.
Suttmeyer points out trading volume has been relatively light. He contends that makes it easier for the big institutional investors to move the market in the direction they want. Asset manager James Weiss says after the huge sell-off, the law of supply and demand meant prices had nowhere else to go but up.
If on any given day there are 10,000 investors that want to buy the stock and only 3,000 investors that want to sell it, the price of the stock has to go up.
Weiss says mom-and-pop investors will now need convincing they're not buying in at the top. But market strategist Richard Suttmeyer says they don't have the cash the government keeps handing out to the bigger investors.
It's creating an asset bubble on speculation. Speculation that the economy is going to turn around and be a lot better. But I'm still seeing data that suggests that that's wishful thinking.
Other market analysts argue the stock market is looking to the future and seems convinced a recovery is underway. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
There was some of that upward recovery momentum on Wall Street. Today we will have the details when we do the numbers. If you're still celebrating the Dow Industrials reaching 10,000, here's a little buzzkill for you. Guess what else is going up? Foreclosures. Over the past 3 months, banks have filed papers on nearly a million homes. That's up almost 25% over last year. And those foreclosures are spreading to more middle-class and upper-income neighborhoods, too. Kurt Nickisch reports now from WBUR in Boston.
Foreclosure auctions are now hitting the affluent suburbs of Boston. 2 weeks ago, a bank foreclosed on this single-family colonial with a white picket fence.
Going once, hearing no further advance, over $365,000. Going twice, hearing no further advance. Satisfied?
The reason for these spreading foreclosure auctions is not those crazy interest rate mortgages. It's the recession. Nowadays, people are losing their homes the way they used to before the subprime crisis.
Historically, people lost their home when they lost their job, they lost their health, or they lost their spouse.
Job losses are to blame again now, according to Nicholas Ritsinas, a housing economist at Harvard. After a while, even middle-class and upper-income households run out of savings and can no longer make their payments. The consulting firm RealtyTrack says out of every 136 homes across the country, one is in foreclosure.
The number of distressed homes coming through the pipeline has actually never been greater than right now.
That's mutual fund manager Whitney Tilson, who's worried about what these new foreclosures will do to the economy. He says they're bound to push the housing market down further, especially in those mid and higher tier neighborhoods where more foreclosures are popping up.
This is something that's going to be with us for a while, and there's no real way to hurry it up. As Warren Buffett said, you can't get nine women pregnant and have a baby in 1 month.
Another worry is that many of these distressed homes were financed by so-called jumbo loans, the kind that are too big for the government to back, so banks carry more of the risk. When these high-end homes foreclose, it's on their balance sheets. That makes banks even more nervous to lend until the crisis clears. In Boston, I'm Kurt Nikisch for Marketplace.
The crisis in residential real estate, we all know. That story's been out there for a good couple of years now. But even a quick listen to one of the business news channels in the past several months will have alerted you to the next big economic story.
All right, a major downturn is expected in commercial real estate in the next few years.
Truly a slow-motion car crash here.
It is going to be a torpedo amidships. It is going to be a major
blow. Real estate might be sort of the next shoot.
We asked Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson whether those dire warnings have any truth to them.
Unemployment will probably hit 10% by the end of the year. That means fewer workers, which means less demand for offices and stores. In other words, the commercial real estate situation isn't getting better. It's getting worse.
The problem is real. It is serious. I don't think we know when the other shoe is going to drop, if you will.
Ken Laurie is co-chair of the real estate department at the law firm Bingham McCutcheon. He says as vacancy rates go up, property values are falling. So just like in the housing crisis, commercial mortgages are going underwater. Borrowers owe more than the value of their properties. And potential buyers can't get loans from the banks.
It's hard for people to buy or sell real estate. Or if they do buy or sell, they have to sell at lower prices because the people that are buying are going to have to put up more equity and less loans.
Perhaps nowhere is the drop in property values as severe as it is here in Manhattan's Stuyvesant town. I'm standing in an 11,000-apartment commercial property that sold for $5.4 billion in 2006. Today, it's worth less than half that. Who's on the hook if borrowers default? It's the banks.
As the old quip goes, if you owe the bank $1 million, you're in quite a bit of trouble. But if you owe the bank $1 billion, the bank is in quite a bit of trouble.
Chris Cornell is a commercial real estate expert at moodyseconomy.com. He says the nightmare scenario is that a spike in commercial loan defaults could send the banks into another financial crisis. He says that's exactly what happened last month when Chorus Bank in Illinois was seized by the federal government.
We fear that sort of phenomenon is going to play out in bank after bank throughout the country.
Now, when economists talk about the other shoe dropping, they're talking about the renegotiation of commercial loans. Many of these loans mature after just 5 years. During the boom, banks had no problem extending the loans because the price of real estate was going up. Not anymore, Cornell says.
The worst of the bubble in this market was 05, 06, and 07. Adding 5 years, that means the trouble is expected in 2010, 11, and 12.
In other words, that shoe is dropping pretty slowly and giving banks time to shore up their finances and prepare for losses. Hessam Naji directs research for Marcus and Millichap Real Estate Investment Services in California. He says, in the meantime, banks are holding the loans on their books at full value and employing a tactic you might call delay and pray.
The bottom line is lenders are, as a result, extending loans and trying to avoid short-term additional losses until they get stronger and have their wherewithal to start to process some of the undervalued real estate.
He says the good news is, unlike in the housing market, there wasn't as much overbuilding in commercial real estate, so getting back to normal will be easier. Susan Wachter is a professor of real estate at the Wharton School. She sees no risk of the kind of system failure we experienced last year.
The commercial real estate crisis isn't going to bring capital markets to a halt.
She says the commercial market is only a third the size of residential, and distressed commercial property owners are likely still collecting rent. Income is still flowing in.
Putting the property into default foreclosure would stop that income flow. It's not in the interest of either the lender or the manager owner of the property. There's much more likely to be negotiations among these parties.
Other than some rainfall, Stuyvesant Town is pretty peaceful today. But high-stakes negotiations between the owners and their lenders continue. Wachter says for a recovery to happen, banks will have to loosen lending again. Making that happen in housing has required hundreds of billions of dollars from the government. It seems commercial real estate may need a dose of the same medicine. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Coming up, Halloween's hot sellers.
We sell bags of intestines. And
what am I going to do with it?
Well, you're going to hang it in places around your house to create a Halloween scene for the kids.
Yeah, not in my house. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gained 47 points today, nearly a half of 1%, finished at 10,062. NASDAQ ticked up a point, closed basically flat, 2,173. The S&P 500 clawed up 4 points, just over a third of 1%, finished at 1,096. Nokia's smartphones lost ground to the iPhone and the BlackBerry in the third quarter. That and the company's worst results ever cost Nokia more than 11% today. Google outran Wall Street's expectations, reporting its strongest sales in more than a year. And even though the search engine made more than $1.6 billion in profits, investors panned the company anyway. Google sank 1% today. IBM reported higher than expected quarterly profits and raised its full-year outlook. Still, investors downsized IBM stock nearly 0.3%. The price on the 10-year T-note fell. The yield rose. 3.46% is the number you're looking for there. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by SunGard. $25 trillion of investment assets are accounted for with software from SunGard Financial Systems. More information at SunGard.com. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to business news and updates on the fallout from the financial crisis. Watch the Marketplace whiteboards and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The Federal Reserve reports on industrial production for September. The University of Michigan releases its preliminary October survey of consumers. How do they feel about the economy? And young activists from around the country are in Washington for a conference on securing a better economic future. The agenda covers the Great Recession and its impact on young people, among other topics. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. After Tad Friend's mother died, he wrote a piece in the New Yorker magazine about her. He's a staff writer there. And he talked about her life, her house, and what it was that drove her. She, like his father, had come from a long line of wealthy and influential East Coasters, the kind of people that ran this country once upon a time. But by the time Tad's parents got together, there wasn't much money left and even less power. They were a very particular kind of American, white, Anglo-Saxon, and Protestant. Tad Friend has turned that column into a book exploring the history of his family and its WASPness. It's called Cheerful Money. Tad, thanks for coming on the program.
Great to be here.
The definition, of course, of WASP is white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant. We all know that. But it is somehow more than that, right? What's the difference between popular perception and the actual definition of the word?
People who consider themselves to be WASPs feel like people who are technically WASPs, Elvis Presley or Bill Clinton, don't really fit into the definition that WASPs have of themselves, which would be basically people who have fancy names, like my own theater reporter friend, and who went to fancy schools and who never talk about their feelings.
Like you, right?
That's me. I don't even know why I'm here talking to you today.
That's right. Well, you wrote a whole book about not talking about your feelings, so, you know.
Yeah, I guess I have a foot outside the camp now.
That's right. There is this air of money that always seemed, in my mind anyway, to go along with waspishness. Does that apply? Is that true?
Nelson Aldrich wrote a book about 20 years ago, a great book called Old Money, in which he argues that the whole point of being a WASP now is to have once had money. And I think for my family and our friends, we don't have any money left. What we have in the place of money is what that money once bought. So we have ratty old rugs and sort of falling apart desks, and we have one house that's still in the family on the shore of Long Island. We have to rent out pretty much the entire year in order to pay for it.
You might not be the guy to answer this question, but what'd you do with all the money, Ted?
I'm going to say that it wasn't my fault because it was gone before I came along. My father's father, Ted Friend, who was an extremely charming man, he kind of lived out the economist Joseph Sumpeter's idea of evaporated capital. He was a broker, and he not only put his clients into certain firms, but he also put the family money into certain firms such as Hygienic Telephone and Nerlip Mines and Red Rock Cola, none of which, of course, are around today. He had a very poor sense of what the future held.
There's a great shot of him in the book, if I'm remembering correctly. He's sitting at a lawn party or something in a linen suit. He's got these great spectator shoes on with a cocktail in the grass at his feet, right? Is that him?
Exactly. And that was a very characteristic pose. And he's looking at his watch, sort of like the White Rabbit in Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah.
That seems very metaphorically resonant to me, wondering where the time went and what happened.
There was this point in the 60s where WASP became this sort of semi-official term. And at the same time, really, that's when the influence started to decline. What do you suppose happened there?
Digby Balzo wrote a book in 1964 that really popularized the term WASP, called The Protestant Establishment. And I argue in the book that actually the following year, 1965, was the sort of pivot point where WASP's power, which had already been waning, began to really sharply drop off. 1965 was the first year of affirmative action. It was the year of the Watts riots. A lot of things that had been sort of lingering on for years suddenly fell off a cliff, even down to my dad that year deciding to give up his Roman numerals after his name. The idea of being Theodore Wood Friend III no longer seemed like something you would sport proudly, but seemed like something you wanted to bury and just become Dory Friend, which he did.
This is, in a lot of ways, a coming-of-age memoir. It's the story of your life, and you begin with your childhood, and you end with your two children. What do you think they will think of their family when they eventually read this book?
That's a question I was thinking about as I wrote the book. Often they were on my lap actually typing in random syllables, which is very helpful. I want them to know everything about me. I want them to feel like they understand me fully. But I also, at the same time, and I know it's a bit of a mixed message, don't want them to feel the impress of WASP culture that I felt, to feel like I have to behave in a certain way. We've skipped, you know, giving them godparents or christening cups or even a christening. We did give them these WASPy names, Walker and Addie, and we actually gave them each four names, so they have two middle names. So they're going to have that little bit of a burden. But I think the main thing I want them not to have from my upbringing is the sense of emotional restraint and the sense that you cannot ever talk about sex or anger or feelings of shame or inadequacy or being picked on in school or any of those things that I felt were, you know, just impossible to raise with my parents.
Ted Friend is a staff writer for The New Yorker. His book is called Cheerful Money: Me, My Family, and the Last Days of WASP Splendor. Ted, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
Forget that Bernie Madoff mask that's topping the charts as the scariest Halloween costume this year. How about the new American consumer, the frugal shopper who's spending about 15% less on Halloween than he did last year? That is spooky news for purveyors of pumpkins and creators of costumes, but it doesn't mean retailers aren't putting their best mask forward, as Cash Peters found out in Las Vegas earlier this year.
I didn't know this, but there's a trade show each year devoted entirely to Halloween. Seriously. Eileen Oswald handles their PR.
People come to a Halloween show to buy costumes, to buy props, to buy makeup, a million different products to celebrate the season.
Amazing, really, given that the season lasts just one day. Dorothea Pacini sells Halloween masks.
It's actually one of the biggest holidays in the United States in terms of merchandising.
Yeah, but what about the other 364 days when people aren't interested in Halloween?
Well, you know what? There is a select group of people that are interested in Halloween all year.
Most of them heavily medicated, I'm guessing. Oh, and if you're wondering why Dorothea sounded slightly muffled, she was dressed as a vulture. But this isn't the place to come if you're squeamish. Everywhere you look, there are people selling severed limbs in bulk or a small, tasteful mound of skulls for your front yard. $80 wholesale. Or for $300, a life-size pirate that shakes. Like that. Shaking has taken over from fiendish cackling as the new big thing. Dave Gottschalk of Gag Studio.
This is Captain Flog'em. He is kind of the nasty version of Johnny Depp. A lot of people come in and say, gee, he kind of looks like Keith Richards.
There isn't an exhibit in this entire show that doesn't look like Keith Richards, I have to tell you.
That's true.
As always, of course, there was all kinds of interesting stuff. Bill Shea sells that other Halloween staple, the disembowel corpse.
We sell bags of intestines and...
What am I going to do with it?
Well, you're going to hang it in places around your house to create a Halloween scene for the kids and...
And you've not been called by the social services?
Oh, no, not at all.
What do you sell?
We sell a candy product. It's called Pucker Powder.
This is Bruce Goldstein of Creative Concepts.
And what's Pucker Powder?
And Pucker Powder is basically, if I can say this, it's like a make-your-own pixie stick. But it's not pixie stick because that's a Nestle product. Pucker.
So because, basically this is some kind of counterfeit.
That's the best. No, not at all. Not at all.
It's how many lawsuits so far? Just give me some
zero,
kind of
zero.
Oh,
not
really?
One. Now, why would we? Because it's Pucker Powder.
Oh, of course it is. Actually, though, counterfeiting is a serious threat to a show like this. Bill Shea, the intestine guy, also sells pirate skeletons with flashing eyes, and he claims manufacturers come over from China, take his ideas for pirates, then return home and pirate them.
They're king in China of... being able to reproduce something someone else already made, not the original ideas of any kind. I mean, I've heard people say they're worried, oh, China's going to take over the world. They'll never take over the world. They'll always need someone to tell them what to do.
Nothing racist about that, then.
It's not a racist thing. It's just it's culturally.
Wow, that's a serious accent. Oh, look who's back. It's Dorothea again. Only this time she was wearing a big purple bug-eyed mask with feathers.
What is she now?
She's the Galeon.
She's gay and she's an alien.
That's right.
I'm Galeon.
You're a Galeon.
Yes, showtime, showtime.
Jazz hands.
Jazz hands, jazz hands.
And what makes that mask so gay?
I just think it's the personality behind it.
Oh, yeah? Or maybe it's just plain old homophobia masquerading as fun. Who knows? Anyway, I was honestly shocked at how popular Halloween is. According to the show's PR woman, Eileen Oswald, this is one industry that may well be recession-proof.
People dress their pets now. So you have... pet outfits, you have children's outfits.
People are pathetic, aren't they, really?
It's anything for a bit of fantasy.
So what will you be going as this year?
With my particular personality, a witch suits me just fine.
You are extremely difficult, I have to be honest.
She was. In Las Vegas, I'm Cash Peters for Marketplace.
Cash Peters is a humorist. His latest book is called Naked in Dangerous Places.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note before we go today, I don't know if you remember, but a couple of months ago, we did a story on how South Dakota has become the place for credit card companies to set up shop. That is because, in large part, the state doesn't have any limits on the interest rates that banks and credit card issuers are allowed to charge. That, in turn, gets you things like this. A card offered by Premier Bank, based in Sioux Falls, carrying an annual interest rate of 79.9%. All of it perfectly legal. That is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 47 points, nearly a half percent. The NASDAQ added a point. We'll call that, yep, flat. The S&P 500 gained 4 points, 0.4%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the program, walking a righteous path with the hip-hop star, The RZA.
You could be in a small apartment inside a project. If you have the right mentality, that project could be a paradise for you. But it's the mentality that we carry with ourselves every day that makes our surroundings uglier than what they really are.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.